Okay, hi everyone, and welcome to our History of Environmental Justice workshop. So this is a new offering that we're debuting right now. And what we're going to do is go over the faith-based history of the environmental justice movement, and then talk about what has been going on historically in Washington as well. Before we get to that, I'll introduce myself. So I am Kia Colucci, and I am the Multi-Faith Program Manager at Earth Ministry Washington Interfaith Power and Light. I'm going to say WIPL from now on, so I don't have to say our full title.
I have my mic.
Oh, you have your mic.
Hi, everyone. I'm Maddie Smith. I am on staff at Earth Ministry WIPL as the Operations Manager. But we are small, so I get to do fun things like this, too. Yeah, and my faith tradition is Unitarian Universalism.
Okay, so if you don't know much about us, Earth Ministry WIPL has been around for 30 years, and in this time, we have been working on environmental justice through toxics, fossil fuels, treaty rights, etc. It has always been embedded in our work, and we found a need to directly define and give historical context to what environmental justice means. So everyone who works with us, they're already doing it. They just may not know the larger context. And that is why I have created with my coworkers a series of environmental justice workshops. So you get the history, you get the specifics of Washington State. Sorry if anyone is out of state. And then we're going into by faith tradition. So what does Judaism say about environmental justice? What does Christianity say, etc.? And those are more like text study workshops, but we won't be doing those here. This is the history. The objective of this workshop is to understand what environmental justice is, and then we are going to understand how people of faith play a role in working for environmental justice historically and in the present. So we're going to start off with you helping us. So we are defining things, and yeah. Maddie will do this portion.
So some of the, you know, terms we talk a lot about in our work are equity and justice. Curious if anyone can throw out a definition for equity. Don't worry about being wrong necessarily. And then we'll talk about it. And I can write it up here as well.
Does anyone want to give it a go? I'll bring the mic to you.
It's a big word, I know, equity.
Fairness.
So that was fairness, if you didn't hear.
I feel like I can yell loud enough to go through the mic. I think of it as equal access.
Did I see a hand?
I think of an image I've seen often of there are three people trying to look over a fence at a baseball game. And the people are three different heights. And so equality is giving everyone the same size stepladder to stand on to look at the baseball game. And equity is realizing that they're starting in different places. And so to look over the fence, they need different size stepladders. And so kind of a recognition that people are starting in different places and need different have different things they need based on that.
What's your name?
Callie.
Well, Callie is perfectly right. I don't need to define it for you. You just got a very good definition with an added image. Okay, and then if we want to get into the justice aspect, especially as it pertains to environmental justice.
Yeah, what does justice, what's a definition you would come up with for justice? It's a big word also.
I could go with Bridget's word fairness on that one.
Yeah. Fairness?
It was real nice that you gave all three of us the same height of the box, but that still didn't put me so I could see over the fence. Mm-hmm. which I don't think is real fair. Justice means you are aware that different things need to be met differently. So my answer is that fairness is that somebody can look at it and say, the same box doesn't fit all needs.
We tend to look at fairness as something that relates to our laws and our practices, and justice tends to be also used for the consequences of violating those things, or maybe putting together an agreeable solution to both parties based on disputes. So in that sense, justice and fairness have some different connotations that we see.
I guess I want to say what I think justice is not.
Mm.
And a lot of times in the criminal system, people think of justice as payback.
Mm.
Like, you killed my loved one, so you need to die. That's justice. And I think of justice in those kind of things as reconciliation and healing. And I think, I've not thought about this in terms of the environment, but as I think about it, I'm like, why not? Why not think about justice as reconciliation and healing? Healing the land and healing the people in the context of the whole land. So, I don't know. I'm just kind of throwing that in as, I know it's not a regular definition, but I just get tired of justice as payback. And I'm like, it's not payback. So anyway.
Yeah, justice can definitely be all of these things. It has multiple definitions. Usually it takes into account the oppression of other people and undoing that. And like one good example, I don't know if all of you were here, but land back, like that whole movement. We have destroyed a lot of our world, harmed indigenous people, and giving their land back to them so they can best manage it and do what they want to do, is a form of justice that's very easy to just recognize. Next up, we have a handout, and this is the principles of environmental justice. And then we're going to be getting into groups for this one. Thank you so much, Jessica.
I'll bring them upstairs for you.
Okay, so this handout comes from a conference that happened in 1991. It is the first National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit. And they came up with these 17 principles of environmental justice. At the very top, you can see why they gathered, what they're hoping to achieve. So what I, as you all look over it, maybe think of what is shocking for you to see on here, what most resonates with you. I discuss it with a partner, and then I have additional questions once you've had time to go through all of this. And I'll do maybe like 10 minutes for you all to go over it and discuss it in whatever type of group situation you would like to before we come back. Okay, everyone, if we could come back to the larger group. That's you, Lacey. Does anyone want to share out anything that they discussed in their pairing? Whether it was something shocking, something fun. I don't know if fun is the right word. Something interesting. Does anyone want to share out?
Maybe something that really stood out to you, or...
I was just staring at you, waiting for you to... You were talking, I saw you.
Something that stood out to me was number 13, talking about Environmental justice calls for the strict enforcement of principles of informed consent and halt to the testing of experimental, reproductive, and medical procedures and vaccinations on people of color. And I read that and was like, okay, yes. And was wondering, like, how does this fit into, like, environmental justice and, like, my kind of conception of, like, relating to the land and animals and those kinds of things. I'm like, oh, that doesn't, like, it didn't, like, fit in the same way as the other ones. So I'm like, how do we, like, support this and, like, what's the connection with environmental things? Yeah, so more of a question than, like, a,
Does anyone else want to share their thoughts?
I would say the same thing about 15 and the military occupation, which was one that did jump out at me, largely because of my concern about the oppression of the Palestinian people. And I understand it very much as a justice issue. Mm-hmm. But within environmental justice, that was kind of a, oh, really? sort of thing.
I think what stands out with both of these is like the sacrificing of bodies of siblings and the space and ability to thrive for those siblings. And if we think about our human family as part of creation, as part of the environment, then that does not, you know, we wouldn't want, there's tons of like animal rights activists, right, who would identify as environmentalists, and like we should be just as appalled when that's happening within our own species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think keeping in mind when it comes to like medical testing and people not actually being healed for syphilis when, you know, that's what they were being experimented on, was to find a cure, but really it was just to see how their bodies react to nothing. Spreading disease is an environmental issue. And then maybe me and Maddie were discussing Hanford, which could speak to 15, if you want to say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I was remarking on like a little bit of the like military occupation, but then like also what happens after that, like, you know, creating of the nuclear bombs partly happened at Hanford in World War II, and like the legacy that's left over from that, and like of toxic waste, like near native land, on native land, and like seeping into the Columbia River, which is really, really important to native peoples in Washington and Oregon.
Kelly remarked.
Kelly remarked that one of the things that emerges from the document is the complexity of striving for justice. Because it, you know, there are personal actions that we need to take, and that comes up in 17. There's education that needs to happen, so that's a system. There's corporations, right, and the way business is conducted. There's public policy and how governments function. There's military activity that's in this as well. So that, you know, as you're striving for justice, you're working across systems and processes in different human groups and collectives in order to do that work. So it's really, I could spend a long time looking at this document just to kind of wrap my head around the complexity of it. And so we both appreciated that dimension of the document.
Yeah, there's a lot there, and Kia and I were like, gosh, this document is older than us, and like, why don't more people know about it? Like, there's a whole lot there to talk about.
Yeah. And then, I should speak into this. The next portion of this will be another discussion where we will be going over those two questions. I'll just give an example of where my train of thinking is, and it could be applied to a number of areas. So what does environmental injustice, or how does environmental injustice manifest? And then I just personally have a big interest in agriculture, so that's where this is going to be. So the injustice is that Western stewardship of the land and lack of environmental protections is causing things like extreme heat waves. And it's on native land that's already being exploited. Then you have farm workers, most of which are immigrants, and language is a barrier. They are not being given the proper notification of how to take care of themselves or for legal help if they need it during heat waves. And as a result, they are out in extreme conditions picking the fruit, vegetables, because they're paid by piece. So even taking a break and having cold water, which are also things not necessarily provided by the farm owners. That's a great injustice, because they are sacrificing their bodies in order to have an income and to feed us. And sometimes we don't think about where the food that we are consuming is even coming from. So that's a great injustice. And so what would justice for them look like? Could be a variety of things. I don't have as big of an imagination to envision what a completely just world would look like for them in this situation. But things like having Inslee finally call like a climate emergency to get better protections. So they had temporary protections a couple years ago when we had, I don't know what the weather was like here, but down south and in central where they're farming, it got really hot, hotter than I've ever experienced. And during that, they had protections like extra water, extra cover, they could take breaks. The government said farm owners had to do this, but they weren't compensated, and when it came to letting them know, it wasn't in a language that they could read. So rectifying that, having it in any language, having more legal help at hand, getting farm workers or owners just to do better, and getting a lot more explicit legal protections that are not temporary, but always to protect them. So those are some forms of what justice could look like. You can be in your groups that you were in last time or in a different group, but what does environmental, or how does environmental injustice manifest in any realm? We have a whole list here of different ways. So how do you see it manifesting, and what would the justice of fixing that injustice look like? And then I'll do 10 minutes again. Okay, everyone, if we could come back to the larger group.
Oh, let me.
And then does anyone have anything that they would like to share out? You don't have to, but if you want to share something.
So one thing that we talked about was thinking about, I'm on staff here at Holden, so I live here. I live on by an old mine that has been had some remediation efforts, and thinking about that compared to other places where toxic mining waste is still very present and affecting people's drinking water, and people being dependent on mines for economic livelihoods, but also having it like literally denying them a basic need. And so what is the difference between places where mines aren't cleaned up and here, and thinking about like, well, there's this is a popular area for a lot of outdoor recreation and by a lot like a predominantly white community, and so how is that different from places where indigenous communities are not getting these big cleanup efforts happening, and what would justice look like? Would it just be getting mining companies to clean up and trying to restore the forest, or you know, does it go even deeper than that in terms of where people can find their livelihoods, but not have it be something that's actively degrading their health and their landscape.
Yeah, thank you for that. Does anyone else want to share? James, you're at back. I'll get to you somehow.
Reach!
Yeah, I was thinking that environmental injustice happens when individuals, but more often governments or corporations or, you know, larger entities, I don't want to say it can't be individuals, but the bigger picture comes to mind more often, focus more on profits or their war or their goal and do not take into account how that affects anybody, and then goes, oh, we'll deal with that later, and then they do or don't deal with that later. And I think back to the grape boycott. I know that predates a lot of you. But hopefully, you know, history. And Cesar Chavez said our people are, you know, exposed to toxins and we got to stop it. And the big it got momentum. And it got momentum in white communities. And it was one of the reactions of the grocery stores and the producers was, we've tested the grapes. And they're good. And, you know, I'm from California, so this was a huge deal there. And I was like, it's not about me and the residual. Yes, health, my health is important, and I don't want to say that's not. But it was like they were making it, they were trying to get people to buy grapes again and saying, you're safe eating the grapes, and ignoring the fact that the whole point was the workers are in the field while you're spraying the toxins on them. We have to stop that. Just because you've sprayed the toxins off by the time I eat the grapes is not the point. And, you know, eventually we won. But it took decades. I mean, it was a long fight. And now they have to, people can't go into the fields until a certain amount of time after the spraying so that the residue's gone. But anyway, it was just kind of like the response was not taking into account the effect on everybody. To try to get me to start buying grapes. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's all over the place. I think that's the halfway point, it'll be okay because instead of really looking deep at who's affected, and of course when who's affected are poor, you know, field workers who are often undocumented, their voice doesn't get heard. So.
Thank you, Janice. Okay, so we have done a lot of good work talking about the historical, you know, events, context of environmental justice in a more secular way, I guess we could say. However, the faith-based historical context is also incredibly important. So forgive me, I have lots of notes and I will be looking at my iPod, iPad for a lot of it. I don't want to assume, but if you are, is anyone here a member of the United Church of Christ? No? Okay. Well, they have done a lot of good work for environmental justice. They are where the phrase environmental racism comes from. So starting, we're still back in time, but we're going even further back, 1982. So North Carolina chose a predominantly African-American neighborhood to put a toxic landfill to illegally dump stuff there. And it was on a roadway that involved 14 different counties. Thank you, Maddie. Residents of Warren County specifically went to the United Church of Christ to ask them for help, and their Commission for Racial Justice helped engage in a campaign of nonviolent civil disobedience. So we're going to be in a few decades. So the first report came out in 1987, and then 2007, and then there's one in 2020, which is also sad because it's still going on, only mildly getting better. What they did was they commissioned a study to see where these landfills, toxic waste dumps were occurring. And they found that predominantly they were being put in areas that were mainly for, or mainly Black people, Hispanics, Latina people, Native Americans, Asian Pacific Islanders, farm workers, and poor citizens. It was happening in the neighborhoods that they all resided in. The reason for this is they are more vulnerable, but just because they are perceived as being weaker and not going to fight back against what is happening in their neighborhoods, which is not true, but that is the logic behind the people doing this. So as I mentioned before, it was the 1987 study. It was written by Charles Lee, the Reverend Benjamin Chavez, who was the executive director. And they referred to intentionally selecting communities of color for waste disposal sites and facilities that are doing harmful pollution, which basically condemned them all to be contaminated by whatever waste it was. They are the ones who wrote that this is environmental racism. As I mentioned before, that is where the term comes from. And then after that initial report, there was the 2007, and unfortunately, the data in the study conclude that the same thing is happening in the same areas. But they do focus mostly on the South, so like everywhere from like Oklahoma, Texas, over is where most of the studies were. But then there were a couple in like Montana, Colorado, California, Oregon, Washington. And I think one went into Toronto. They got there as well. And it just shows that in all of these areas, so you have things like Cancer Alley, which is down in Louisiana, still going strong. And that was still in their 2020 report. And they took a different approach to the 2020 report. So this one's called Breath to the People, Sacred Air and Toxic Pollution. And their focus here was on children. So it did, the research was about different groups of people, but it was mostly children under 5, adults over 64, communities of color, and the working class poor. And it showed that, so low income had the most facilities in these areas, with 65 within a 100-mile radius. And then kids under 5 had 56, which that's a significant drop. But then people of color had 51, and then if you were over 64, it was 43. So 112,500 children under the age of 5 in our nation live within 3 miles of 100 super polluting facilities. So they focused in on that, one of which, for Washington purposes, is in the Seattle Everett Bellevue area. They don't go into detail about the ones we have here. Their focus is, again, from like Texas over, but they were listing the states where it is, and then one down in Tacoma, Washington. So yeah, and their approach in this one is about hope. So how, yes, this is horrible, yes, this is our third report since 1987, but there is hope, and they give mostly like practical solutions, maybe not solutions, but ideas. So a quarter of toxic pollution that they found was through leaks, so people not managing the facilities well enough. So fix that. Then there was a lot of the expansion is rapid right now for these facilities, but the people working in them, who a lot of times are people of color, who English is not their first language, they're not given info on it in a language that they can read easily. So one of their suggestions was give the info in the language that these people can read. And hopefully that spurs them into action, like, oh, I really understand what is going on. And then they get more voices. Intentionally not giving people literature and language in the language that they know is deliberate. And then there's also, of these 100, like, super facilities, the EPA is supposed to be tracking like the mega ones. So of these 100, 19 were considered high priority violators by the EPA. So just, you know, holding them more accountable for what they're doing. They're called super emitters, is what they are. But they're not really being dealt with rapidly enough, obviously. And so that was their suggestion, and they just wanted to emphasize, like, five-year-olds are dying because all of these facilities, they're breathing more, their bodies are more susceptible to all of this. And it's not okay, because this is my interpretation of it. But focusing on communities of color in the last few wasn't enough. Now it's like, well, what about the children as well? And so they're taking another angle while still including people of color in it to try and get something done. They're working hard. They've done a lot of good work historically for getting people to talk about it. But that is to be determined where it'll go and if anything new will come out of this. The next portion is semi, I don't know if I call it historical, 2019?
That's history.
That's history. We're going to talk about the Washington State Task Force and the work they've done.
Yeah, and I just want to say, like, and can't emphasize this, but like how deep the like religious and spiritual roots of this movement, like, that was led by Black clergy in the 80s, and like we forget that a lot, I think, and like white congregations that maybe are working on creation care, environmental stewardship. And that feels really important to me. And even looking at this, the principles of environmental justice, like he and I were just talking about how like the language in the preamble and like specifically the first principle, like, really has a lot of spiritual, religious connotations in the language that's used, and, like, environmental justice movement isn't just about, like, woke left-wingers, you know, like, it's really about, like, it really started with religious folks and, like, Black clergy, and that's important to remember, I think. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about Washington and like what's going on here specifically and trying to address, like, we've talked a lot about what's wrong, and then like let's talk a little bit about what's happening in Washington and like what and like how it's being addressed. So Washington has something called the Washington Environmental Justice Task Force, which came really out of organizing, yeah, Jessica, fist pump the task force. And this really came out of years of organizing by people of color-led environmental justice organizations, which I'll talk a little bit about later, like some examples of ones in Washington that we really think that folks should get involved with and support and listen to. And so this task force like came about as a way to say, like, frontline communities, and when I say frontline communities, I mean like some of these communities Kia was talking about, and like what the UCC reports found are the folks who are most affected by pollution or environmental injustices like that, or health disparities. So like that's predominantly people of color and Native folks. And poor folks, like, in our state. And so that is who they felt like wasn't, they felt like they weren't being represented in talking about environmental policies in our state. And, like, people like to think of Washington State as, like, more progressive than some other states, and, like, maybe that's true. And certain voices still aren't being really listened to. And when we're talking about making policy and sort of reconciliation and healing and of both the earth and communities. And so we had the task force for a little while, but it didn't really have any power. And so back in 2019, a bill was first introduced in the Washington State Legislature, which usually happens January to March or January to April, May-ish, depending on whether it's a short session or a long session, and they alternate every year. And this bill was called the HEAL Act, H-E-A-L, which stands for Healthy Environment for All, Act, and it was really a serious piece of environmental justice legislation. It didn't pass the first year it was up, and then in 2020, a version of it did end up passing the Washington State Legislature, and the Earth Ministry community like helped support that passage, but it was really led by our partners at Front and Centered, which I'll talk a little bit more about later, but they're a coalition of environmental justice organizations throughout our state. And so the like passing that bill gave the task force a little bit more teeth and a little bit more like they have to look at things, like they have some power. It's not just saying like, oh, you know, we listen to those affected communities and we're still gonna do this. Like that's still an issue, I think. But like they exist and they have a bit more power than they used to, which is good. One of the things that came out of the Environmental Justice Task Force in our state is something called the Washington Environmental Health Disparity Map. And I'm gonna write this down because I think it's really important. Okay, Kia. This is the best marker. And so this, did somebody say something?
I said tag it as the best marker.
Oh, too. It really is the best marker too.
Because there's plenty of dead ones.
So, and Kia also has this pulled up on her iPad. And so if folks afterwards like are curious and want to look at the Washington Environmental Health Disparities Map, it's really a like deep resource of data and like I think looking on it about where you live or where you're from or places you've been in Washington, because I know not everyone here is from Washington State. Like there's just a deep breadth of information there that shows everything from like correlating racial demographics of areas to like the average life expectancy of people living there, like people that are born into that zip code or like census tract. And like actually looking at some of the like pollution that affects people that live there. Like I think it's like it can show ozone and then a couple other things, right, Kia?
Like premature death,
yeah, low like birth weight, those mm-hmm. all those sorts of things. And so like we have this great resource that was put together by the task force in partnership with the State Department of Health, and like I think some folks at the University of Washington were involved in it too. So like it's a really deep resource, and the question is like, what do we do with that? Like we know the issues, we can see the data, but like then what do we do about it? And so another part of the like HEAL Act that passed that sort of relates to this map is it requires, like the original version of the bill was gonna require, I believe, all, I'm looking at Jessica because she's our policy person, would have required like all state agencies to like consider and think about and implement environmental justice in their all of their work. And so like these state agencies are part of the executive branch of our state government. So they implement laws that are passed in our state. And the way the bill ended up getting passed and was changed with only a few specific agencies that have to follow this, I believe it's like the Department of Ecology, seven.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the Department of Ecology, I believe Department of Health is on there.
Transportation.
Agriculture. So like that's a big step, and it's not as big as we had wanted it to be, but like to get the bill passed, that's what had to happen. And remember, it didn't pass the first year it was introduced, so like this takes, like it takes a bit of time, which is unfortunate because this is so important. But maybe in the future, like that will be an update or upgrade for like to get more of the state government thinking about environmental justice and all of their work, because it really does affect everything. And so a couple of the like the environmental task force environmental justice task force meets every so often, and they have come out with like a set of policy recommendations for our state, and like they can recommend them, but then we have to like actually get them passed in the legislature. So one of the like big ones was engage tribes or indigenous peoples whenever an agency's program or service may impact them, while noting that this form of engagement is not a substitute for government-to-government or cultural resource consultations, but it's a step. And so, like, part of, and then this environmental health disparities map was also one of their recommendations. Like, state agencies should create a standard method to develop, track, evaluate, and publish environmental justice and health goals focused on preventing pollution and improving engagement in overburdened communities, which is a way to say communities that are experiencing more pollution and like environmental injustices that are affecting health in their daily lives. I'm trying to see if I missed anything. And like the map is really cool. I really encourage, Kia, do you have it up?
Not yet, I have it on.
Oh, low battery, okay.
They're playing low right now.
But I would really encourage people to like look it up. Like I think if you Google this, it should come up pretty quickly. It does, Jen?
Yeah, I just did.
Great, love it. But it's like a really important tool. Jessica.
Carry on, but I wanna. Can I add one thing?
Yeah.
So we'll be talking a bit more about ongoing advocacy efforts in tomorrow's workshop. Hope to see you there. But I just want to tack on about the HEAL Act and the implementation of the EJA Council now being part of providing feedback to the state. We still have more advocacy to do, right? So this is very new, and we've already seen, and some of what Van and Sharon and I were talking about from our principal conversation applies to this, because we've already seen a lot of it saying, like, oh, well, we have this, it's great, we did it, right? But in how the processes are unfolding, the Environmental Justice Council is being treated more kind of as an afterthought and not at the table from the get-go, where like really policies are shaped. But you know, once things really get to the rulemaking or the public comment periods that we mobilize people of faith to participate in, things are, you know, there's a good solid draft that's been made, and the folks most impacted need to be able to be at the table to help inform that draft, and given the time and the cultural, the cross-cultural elements of time, especially with Native nations, is really important. And that is not something we saw in some rulemaking that just happened this spring. So we are following the lead of Front and Centered and how to respond to that. We submitted a pretty strongly worded organizational comment about that. And I'm foreseeing that much of our advocacy will be saying, okay, we need to be sure that we're actually walking the talk and ensuring that the HEAL Act is implemented in a way that's meaningful.
And if you're going to deal with this in another session, I will defer, but I wonder what, who are the opponents to this act? I mean, was there lobbyists? Who were they? Were they, you know, backdoor opponents, or were they, you know, outwardly vocal in advertising? I mean, I'm just curious, because it seems like such a nice, and that's me, but it seems like such a nice act, like, who would openly oppose? But I'm just curious how that, so obviously you had to do compromises to get it through.
Right.
And who, why and how? And again, if you need to defer that to another session, I respect that.
Yeah, the really short answer is industry.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Industry.
Regulated community, which is now what they're calling themselves.
Yeah. So they're saying we have enough regulations.
Terrible.
And I can hear AC has thoughts on that. But anyway.
Yeah, so short version, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow. I know they have other content to get to, but industry and the idea of like, oh, we already have processes, we already have the environmental impact statements, and we have this this in place, and it's enough. It's not.
Right? Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I appreciate your deep knowledge on the policy shenanigans. Oh, yeah. So now I'm writing these down, and if folks want to come take a picture or, like, write them down, like, this is not exhaustive list, but a start for, like, environmental justice organizations that we're following, some that we're in partnership with, that we think that people of faith should be listening to or following and supporting. I'm almost done writing them. So the first one I talked about a little bit is Front and Center, which was involved in the passage of the HEAL Act and beginning of the Environmental Justice Task Force. And they are a coalition of people of color-led environmental justice organizations in Washington State. And they have a really great website that talks about implementing environmental justice policies in our state. And they're a really great resource that we look to during the legislative session to decide what policies and bills that we want to have this faith community really speak out on in support of. So I definitely encourage folks to look them up. One specifically in Seattle, for any Seattle folks, is called Got Green, which is based in South Seattle and is a local grassroots environmental justice organization. And they actually have their offices in a church, so like they're also connected to the religious community as well. One organization we've partnered with is called Native Daily Network, and they are based out of Tacoma, but they are like a Native-led nonprofit media organization, so they like cover stories on environmental injustices that Native folks are experiencing, and a lot of that ends up being in Washington State because they live here. Specifically, they've done a lot of coverage of the Puyallup tribe in Tacoma's opposition to Puget Sound Energy's Tacoma liquefied natural gas facility. And they actually have a like free, full-length documentary film that follows the Puyallup tribe's opposition to this facility. And I can talk more about this like specific campaign with folks later, and we might touch on it a little bit tomorrow in our Faithful Advocacy Workshop. But their full-length feature film is called Ancestral Waters, and you can stream it for free on YouTube or Vimeo. Highly recommend. Supposedly this fall, they're also coming out with an updated version because the campaign continues. It's like there's like a court legal issue happening now, so it's a little complicated. But we highly encourage folks to like go to their website, read some of their coverage, watch Ancestral Waters if you really want to get fired up. And they're just a great resource to learn and learn about what's happening. Puget Sound Sage is another Seattle-based environmental justice organization, and they're also pretty grassroots, but do stuff in the legislature as well, I believe. Is that right, Jess? And then La Resistencia is based in Tacoma, and they're an immigrant-led group that focuses on supporting folks in detention at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, which is a for-profit immigration prison. And you might say, okay, well, what does that have to do with environmental issues? Well, they happen to be located on a Superfund site in Tacoma, in the Port of Tacoma, which is not zoned for residential, but like no one lives there except for the folks detained there. And they also happen to be in the blast zone of the Tacoma LNG facility. And then you think about like environmental reasons that people are leaving their home countries and like wanting to come to the US. And so they're part of a member coalition that we're also part of that's sort of winding down, but called the Power Past Fracked Gas Coalition. So recognizing that these things are like deeply interconnected and woven together. And we actually, Jessica was here for this, but we actually helped put together a letter about the Tacoma LNG facility from a human rights perspective in Tacoma, because it's not just about the emissions, or like it's about the pollution, the fact that it's being built on the Puyallup tribe's land, and like they have no evacuation plan for the Northwest Detention Center. So like those folks are just stuck there if like something really bad were to happen. I could talk about all of these for a long time, but I know I gotta keep it moving. So Sacred Sea is a Native-led nonprofit that's led by two Lummi Nation matriarchs. Lummi Nation is located up near Bellingham, Washington. So like the north part of the Salish Sea in Washington. And they are all about, so like, and we can talk a lot about this, so I'll try to be quick. But in the Lummi language, like the word that means orca, like, or killer whale, is like our relations under, like it means, literally translates to like our relations under the sea. And so that's like a very different way of thinking about like animals as relatives, and like orcas are really important to like Lummi culture and spirituality. And so there happens to be a orca that was captured and taken from the Salish Sea near Whidbey Island in Penn Cove back in the 70s. She's been named Skelly Chuktanat, but is also known as Tokate or Lolita. And she's currently imprisoned at the Miami Seaquarium. And so their whole movement with the Sacred Sea organization is to try to bring her back to the Salish Sea, not to be released into the wild, but to like be taken care of in like a open water like pen sort of thing. And there's a whole movement behind this around the world to like recognize that like whales and dolphins are really, really smart creatures who need a lot of open ocean and like can't really be kept in captivity. And like I'll mention, like she's the oldest surviving orca that was captured from the wild, still living. She's only like 50 years old or something like that, Jessica.
Her
mother actually is still swimming around the Salish Sea, like in one of the southern resident orca pods. And so like there's a lot of connections drawn that they're drawing between like native boarding schools and like taking native children away from their families, and then like taking their relations under the sea away as well. So like there's some deep spiritual connections there. And then we talked a bit about Community to Community, which is a like farm worker led organization, and they primarily work up in Skagit and Whatcom counties, but I know they have relationships across the state within farm worker communities. And they're also part of Front and Center. And like their main goal is like environmental justice for farm workers. And so like they recently had a press conference down in Olympia, like calling for Governor Inslee to declare a climate emergency because of like the effects of extreme heat on farm workers, like sort of what Kia was talking about. Okay. I think, and I'll keep these up in case people want to come take a picture later. Highly encourage folks to get involved with these organizations, sign up for their email lists. You know, if you have money to donate to organizations, like any of these would be really great. So one last, how many mind. How much time do you have left?
12 minutes.
Okay, perfect. So a couple last things we wanted to talk about is like how to show up. Like, how do we as people of faith show up within the environmental justice movement? Like, both thinking about what's going on currently and then the like deep spiritual roots of this movement, which is led by like clergy, but not white clergy. And like thinking about my faith community is predominantly white, not entirely, but like, what does that mean? So like a couple things I like to think about and how we show up is like, what narratives are you noticing around environmental issues? Like, what side of the story is being told? Who's telling that story? Like, where is the power, like the center of power located in an issue or a story? Because generally it's probably not with the people who are most being most affected by environmental injustices. Who are you getting your info from? Like, I think there's a lot of great environmental organizations, specifically in Washington State. Like, there's a lot going on. And I think it's really important to like make sure that you're getting your info from the people who are most affected by an issue. So that's partly why we really want to encourage the Earth Ministry community to, like, we are listening to these organizations, but we also want you to like be following them and involved in what they're doing. And also, I think, like, what environmental organizations are you supporting? Like, clearly none of us can like get through every email an organization sends to our inbox. I know I certainly can't. But like, maybe you pick and choose a few of these organizations to like keep updated on and like know what they're working on and how that connects to like the greater faith-based environmental movement. For some like specific practical ways to engage, tomorrow Jessica and I will be presenting on faithful advocacy, which will also go into specific campaigns and issue areas that we're working on. So that will be very exciting. Highly encourage you to come to that. Just for like a quick overview, we work in several different issue areas, and we're small. Like, the four of us are who our staff is currently, so like we can't do everything. But we're currently doing a lot of work in salmon and orca recovery, which is in solidarity with Northwest Native Nations, and that's going on right now, and there's a lot there. And we also are working in fossil fuel, like fighting new fossil fuel infrastructure and facilities. A lot of that happens across the state, and like there's a new gas pipeline being proposed that would cut through eastern Washington. And like I talked a bit about Tacoma and like fossil fuel issues there. We also work in the state legislature, as I said, and so like there's a wide variety of bills in different issue areas that we support there, including climate justice bills. Like, one thing we just finished up working on is the implementation of a clean fuel standard, which we just, the comment period just ended for that yesterday, so it didn't quite work out with our faithful advocacy workshop tomorrow, but that's okay. If you're on our email list, you probably saw. I think I remember submitting your comment, Callie. super duper. And then we also work in toxic chemical reform. And so I think I'll stop there since we'll talk more about it tomorrow. Oh, Sharon, did you have a question?
Well, you were saying all these other groups that you could give donations to. I just want to raise up Earth Ministry as a great organization to focus some donations on.
I appreciate that. I didn't say that. And we have a small budget and are doing a lot with what we have. So thank you, Sharon.
Well, thank you.
Kia's going to talk a bit about voting since our election is coming up soon. And it's so great that Holden is like encouraging people to register to vote. I love it.
Yeah, so this is another practical way to engage just very quickly. The best way to get voter engagement is through relations. So talking to people you know. Not the people who always vote, but the people who don't vote or vote infrequently. They are the ones who you're most likely to get when it comes to voter turnout. And so when it comes to this, you don't, they might go over it a little bit tomorrow when it comes to faithful advocacy, but you don't want to just spout facts at people. No one cares. What you want to do is have a genuine conversation about values and stories, and through that, getting the point of what's at stake with these elections. That is the key to doing this. But first, you have to do work yourself and reflect on why turning out to vote is important for you. And then from there, I'm getting some of these next points from Minnesota IPL, who, if you weren't at our workshop yesterday, I Screamed Out Loud is my favorite. I just love them. But what they suggest is creating like a list of 10 contacts that you have. And again, not the people who always vote, or if they always vote, but they're not voting well, they could also be on the list. But what you want to do is do it as soon as possible so they have as much time as possible to vote. You can call or text them however you would normally talk to them. And then they give you a conversation flow. So start by catching up. Ask how they're doing first, especially if you haven't spoken to them in a while, or even if you have, just it's nice to check in on people. When you're doing that, try to figure out what values or issues are important to them, and then connect their values with your own. So if they are afraid of, you know, the climate crisis, you can also explain why you are also afraid. So there's more of a relational aspect to it there. And then connecting your vote, your values to why voting is important. And, you know, if you want to say, if you're excited about voting, like, bring that in. I don't know if anyone's excited to do that, but if you are, and if you're not, you can pretend. So, and then, so they give an example. Say you're excited to vote for candidates who will lead boldly for climate justice. You can ask how they plan to vote or share how you plan to vote. So making clear that there's a plan. I don't know how old everyone is here, but millennials are the late voters. So we tend to, the polls skew one way until we all turn our ballots in an hour before they close, and then it's another way. So maybe having a plan for yourself and getting other people to have a plan as well, I think that's helpful. And then encouraging them to vote early by mail or in person, and if you have a lot of voting knowledge, if they have questions,
and if you live in Washington, you have to vote by mail, which is great.
Yes.
I imagine it must be really fun to like get all the ballots at Holden and like pass them out. I'm just imagining that happening.
Chaotic.
And like to say like this plan about how to vote, like to be clear, that's about like when and how you're going to vote and not who you're voting for, because we're a 501c3 and can't endorse candidates, but we can say, hey, you should vote your values and like...
Well, person to person, you can say whatever you want.
You say whatever you want, yep.
Okay, there's more points. So ask whoever you talk to talk to three friends as well to get them involved. And then once you make your voting plan, follow up. Don't just have the conversation and walk away. 1 to 2 weeks later, make sure they voted. And then I have a couple more resources. So I don't think I explained this, but we, Washington Interfaith Power and Light, is part of a national organization called Interfaith Power and Light. We are just the Washington version. I did mention Minnesota, so that might have been obvious. Sorry if it was. But they also have resources. FaithClimateJusticeVoter.org has a bit on there, but it's skewed for congregational voting, so how to become a congregational captain. And they have a faithful voter reflection guide on there as well. And then here at the snack bar, There's a lot of Washington voter registration info, so that's another place
if
you haven't registered or need to change your registration. Janice, I see you had a question.
I don't know if you have it here, but in California, you can register for this thing that like tracks. You got your ballot in the mail. You should have gotten your ballot in the mail. If you didn't get your ballot in the mail, call, you know, contact us this way.
Yeah, we have that in Washington.
And then when you vote, it actually says, we received your ballot. Mm-hmm. Your vote has been counted. And I think that that's helpful to people to just kind of know, oh, it's happening, and you kind of feel like, it happened. My vote got, you know, counted. And I don't know. If it's here, I would encourage people to sign up for it because it's almost like some outside party is texting me to remind me to get this in. Mm-hmm. So I like it. I just thought other people might as well.
So that's a good outreach point that you could add into your plan is if they're, you know, people don't like to vote or are stressed about voting for different reasons, but knowing that you can watch where your ballot is could be something to point out depending on why they might be nervous to vote or not.
Or just need a reminder because they forget.
Or that. Okay. So we have 1 whole minute left, so we're going to wrap up.
I have one question I want to ask.
One question.
And maybe this is something you'll be thinking about during lunch. So, like, really the point of this workshop is, like, we're all here because we understand, like, the breadth of environmental degradation and, like, climate crisis that we're living, but, like, it does matter how we respond. And, like, as people of faith, it matters how we respond. So, like, one question we just want to leave you with is, how are you engaging with environmental justice in your congregation? And I'll say EJ is a common abbreviation for environmental justice. If you don't, how do you want to engage with EJ in your congregation? We were going to have you all discuss, but now it's lunchtime. So we'll just leave you with that.
To think on. And feel free to take a picture.
And feel free to come up
organizations. And yes, I have the map.
See the map.
If you want to play through it. And thank you so much for coming.